Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. America's civil rights laws were enacted decades ago to stop discrimination and to make sure the best person gets the job, no matter the color of his or her skin. Yesterday, the Supreme Court stirred that pot when it ruled white firefighters in New Haven had been discriminated against. Conservatives cheered. Liberals fear the future for the future of racial equality laws and the decision's impact on affirmative action. This hour on Point, civil rights and the future of affirmative action in our law books and in our communities. You can join the conversation. What do you think about the verdict in the New Haven firefighters case? Was justice served? What's your take on affirmative action and racial equality? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington is Jess Braven. He's Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal. Jess, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Jane.
What's the significance of this ruling?
Well, this ruling really defines what the line is between racial what racial discrimination is in the employment setting. Really, there's been a tension between two elements of the Civil Rights Act. One is something called disparate treatment. That means treating people on the basis of their race, and that's prohibited. Another is something called disparate impact, which originally was conceived as an outgrowth of disparate treatment. You can't always prove that racial bias is the motivation for something. But if you look at the way things work out and it turns out that one group is favored and another isn't, that can be an indication that there really is some racial bias at the core of it. This decision focused on how you separate those two concepts. Mm.
Well, let's hear from the firefighters yesterday first. When the Supreme Court announced its ruling yesterday, the mostly white firefighters, the so-called New Haven 20, they gathered on the steps of the federal courthouse in New Haven, Connecticut to celebrate their victory. And here's one of them, Matthew Marcarelli, saying the long legal battle was worth it.
The truest vindication is the day that we're all going to get pinned our badges on, captain and lieutenant badges that we are entitled to, based upon what the court said. That'll be the ultimate vindication for all of us to set things right.
Matt, was it worth it? It was years you guys waited.
It was worth it, every minute of it. Right, guys?
Yeah.
And here's Karen Torre, lawyer for the New Haven 20, speaking to reporters on the steps of the federal courthouse yesterday, where their lawsuit was first thrown out in 2006. She said this ruling made sure that civil rights laws were applied as they were meant to be.
We had, one might say, the audacity of hope that some court at some point would enforce the letter and the spirit of the civil rights laws, accord to firefighters the recognition and respect that they deserve for their heroic and dangerous work, and reject attempts to lower the professional standards of competence for the sake of identity politics.
So, Jess, what will this ruling mean as a practical matter to thousands of local governments, firefighters, other public employees, and their employers moving forward?
Well, it changes the calculus that their counselor are going to take into account when they look at hiring exams and promotional systems like this one. I mean, avoiding liability is one of the principal things that any organization seeks to do. Employment discrimination is a pretty big area of law, and employers, both private and public, go out of their way to avoid it. This is going to suggest to a lot of municipalities that they don't have to worry as much about a lawsuit for disparate impact. That means the outcome of some employment test that leaves minorities disproportionately underrepresented in the outcome, if they can show that the test that they used was fair and consistent with their what the court calls business necessity.
So that's municipalities. What about private employment? What about private employers?
It's actually similar. It's the same. It's the same test. I mean, the law applies to private employers as well, and if they they also can be sued for violating the Civil Rights Act, which is supposed to promote equal employment opportunity. And they too, if they can show that their test was fair, that the simple numerical distribution disproportionately represents minorities won't be enough to create liability.
The New Haven case reversed a decision by Supreme Court nominee Judge Sonia Sotomayor. I'm curious, Jess, what the reaction to this decision as it relates to her and her prior ruling is.
Well, for Republicans and conservatives who have been looking for anything they can find that might possibly derail her nomination, it was perhaps as good news as they could expect. They immediately jumped on it to show that, boy, she's really out of line here. She was reversed by the Supreme Court. But I think that more dispassionate analysis suggests that there's really not going to be much impact here. The fact is that this is an area of law that really divides legal scholars and judges. The Supreme Court itself was divided 5-4. The Second Circuit Court of Appeals, in which she sits, considering this case as a whole, divided 6-5. It's really something where both positions are within the broader legal mainstream, and mm-hmm. by its nature, the legal mainstream is a disputatious place.
Mm-hmm. Well, speak to that. I mean, will the Supreme Court ruling really clarify employment law moving forward? Because I'm reading a lot of legal scholars this morning who say that this ruling leaves things as muddled as ever for the nation's employers and ensures even more litigation over the issue of employment discrimination moving forward.
Well, lawyers are a creative bunch, and any kind of decision can lead to more litigation, particularly something which changes the law or seems to alter the law in some way, and that always will leave a number of questions unanswered. I mean, the Supreme Court can't anticipate everything that happens. The majority styled its decision as something that would clarify this. Dissenters and critics of the decision would say that, no, actually, it doesn't clarify it. It's been clear before, and now it's sort of confused. What will constitute a fair test? What is the strong basis in evidence, which is the term that Justice Kennedy, who wrote the majority opinion, used? Mm-hmm. What constitutes a strong basis in evidence that a test like this was unfair to minorities? Those are things that will have to be worked out in the lower courts, and the way those courts work it out is through litigation. So, sure, there will be more litigation. I don't know that it's going to lead to some gigantic flow of new lawsuits. Often we hear Supreme Court decisions described as opening the door to some new maelstrom of litigation, and usually it's the same maelstrom of litigation we had before.
Jess Braven, hold on for a moment. I'd like to bring another couple of voices into the conversation for their response to this case. Richard T. Ford joins us from San Francisco. He's a professor of law at Stanford and author of The Race Card, How Bluffing Against Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. Professor Ford, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And Richard Epstein joins us from Chicago, where he teaches law at the University of Chicago. He's author of Principles for a Free Society, Reconciling Individual Liberty with the Common Good. Professor Epstein, nice to have you.
Nice to be here.
Richard Ford, I'll begin with you quickly, if you would. What's your reaction to the New Haven case? Is this ruling part of a steady march to the right for the high court on discrimination cases like this?
Well, I do think it's part of a march to the right. And the most important thing I'd say about this case is that it's beginning to erode the disparate impact standard, one of the more important parts of civil rights law. What it's done now is put employers in kind of a catch-22. If they adopt an employment practice like a standardized test that has a disparate impact on the basis of race, before Ricci, before yesterday, the right thing for the employer to do would be to make sure that test was strongly job-related, that it was the best way to go about selecting people for the job, mm-hmm. and if it wasn't, then you wouldn't want to use such a test that screened minorities or underrepresented groups out of the workforce. Now, if they do that, they might be subject to a reverse discrimination suit. So they're kind of in a tight spot, any employer that's using standardized tests. One thing I predict that this ruling will do will be to discourage employers from using standardized tests if they can avoid it. Mm.
Richard Epstein, what's your take? You hear Richard Ford talking about this catch-22 that our employers will now be in. Let me quote Senator Patrick Leahy, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, okay. who said today that this Supreme Court ruling will result in cutbacks on important protections for American families and that employers will be less likely to, quote, fulfill their obligations under this time-honored civil rights law. Your response?
Well, I think that's a little bit hyperbolic. There is a very difficult problem here, and I think it's a little bit more complex than Richard Ford suggested. What you do is you have somebody who goes out of its way to prepare the ideal test, and it turns out we have an unfortunate consequence that virtually every standardized test seems to produce a disparate impact. And so what happens is when the city of New Haven is sued, it simply decides that if it's got a disparate impact, it won't be able to defend it on business necessity. So what it then decides to do is to just chuck the test. Mm-hmm. Now, this was probably a very defensible test. And what the fellows on the other side were saying is you just cannot take a dive. And they treated it as though it were a collusive settlement between the city on the one hand and a whole variety of civil rights groups on the other hand, which squeezed out these fellows. And I think, in effect, if they had settled the case on somewhat more moderate terms, saying, well, we'll use it for some employees but not for others, it might have gotten a somewhat different reception. But it was the fact that the test was just thrown out, and as best I can tell, it was a pretty carefully administered test without any of the overtones of a sneak effort or an underhanded attempt to try to introduce racial bias through the back door.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about civil rights law and affirmative action in America today. You can join the conversation. Have we become a just, colorblind society? Is it time to put affirmative action policies to bed? My guests this hour are Jess Braven of the Wall Street Journal. He's based in Washington, covers the Supreme Court for the Journal. Richard T. Ford joins us from San Francisco. He's professor of law at Stanford and author of The Race Card, How Bluffing Against Bias Makes Race Relations Worse. And Richard Epstein joins us from Chicago, where he teaches law at the University of Chicago. He is author of Principles for a Free Society, Reconciling Individual Liberty with the Common Good. Professor Epstein, Professor Ford, I want to move fast and past the New Haven case now and talk more broadly about affirmative action, civil rights law in this country. And if you would take off your scholars' hats for a moment and speak as citizens here about this issue. Professor Epstein, did affirmative action civil rights laws in this country achieve their intended goals?
Now, that's a very large question because there are two halves to it. And generally, one half is the coercive half in which you sort of force people to hire without regard to race. And the other is where you give them a deliberate pass, which says that you may engage in race preferences, but only with respect to minority groups. And it's the coercion on the one side and the voluntarism on the other side, which creates a lot of explosive responses here, because one form of discrimination is examined so closely, that is against minorities, and the other is given basically a free pass. So some people think that it's kind of uneasy. And I think there's something to that. There's no question that something had to be done, however, to adjust the situation after the horrific experience on desegregation. And my preference had always been for something like a sunset law, after which you could sort of run your employment situation as you would like it. Because the problem about the majority position in the Supreme Court is that it creates an incredible straitjacket with respect to the way in which employment practices are done. Mm. There is a strong demand in private and public areas for having some degree of affirmative action, and for a court to sort of stand up against that is going to create an inevitable political pushback. On the other hand, these tests are extremely valuable, and the Supreme Court has largely read them out of existence until today, and I thought that was a mistake as well. And so what you really need, in my view, is a situation in which you give some degree of good faith discretion to public officials to decide whom to hire and how, and not to look so hard on the test, which I think will push very much in the wrong direction. So I kind of come in the middle.
So, Professor Ford, what's your take? Has affirmative action, as we know it, perhaps outlived its usefulness? In other words, has it done all it can do?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say that I agree with a lot of what Professor Epstein has said, actually. I don't agree that that there hasn't been much scrutiny of reverse discrimination. I think there's been quite a great deal of scrutiny of reverse discrimination, especially in recent years. But I do agree that the employers need more discretion in their hiring than they have right now. And I do agree that standardized tests like the one in the New Haven case provide valuable information, and it's just not viable to go about hiring in a complex society while eliminating these kind of measures. So the question is, how can they be used consistent with the goals of having more integrated workforces and more equal access? And that's what Title VII has tried to balance, not always perfectly. But I would say that civil rights laws have not finished the job that they were intended to do. They've done a lot to improve our society, but we still have some ways to go. We still have lots of racial inequity, and that's one of the reasons that employers are anxious to, many employers anyway, are anxious to try to continue to integrate their workforces.
Let's listen from hear from a powerful voice on this issue. In the 2003 Supreme Court case, Grutter versus Bollinger, a 5-4 majority ruled that the University of Michigan Law School could use race as one factor in its admissions policy. Here's Justice Sandra Day O'Connor delivering the majority opinion. She says the process was fair because each applicant was looked at individually and race was not the only factor. But she warned the clock was ticking on affirmative action.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
The court delivered a mixed opinion. It left the door open for certain kinds of affirmative action policies, obviously. Professor Ford, what do you make, though, of her comments that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary? The clock's ticking on affirmative action.
Right. That's very interesting. You know, I think that Justice O'Connor has the goal right, that our goal ought to be to move away from explicit race-based decision-making to the extent that that's possible, and that we ought to look forward to a future where things like affirmative action aren't necessary. I'm not so sure that we're going to get there in 25 years, and so that's a bit of an arbitrary timeline, but I would hope that I think most Americans want to move in that direction, and so in that sense, I'd agree with her.
Let's take a call on this because we have a lot of listeners lined up here. First to Detroit, Marion is on the line. Marion, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just want to say that you made a statement that racial discrimination is in the past, and it's not in the past. It's still happening today. We still need the civil rights laws. Unfortunately, and I'm hoping that 25 years we will not need them, but today we need them, mm-hmm. especially in Detroit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Professor Epstein, would you respond?
Well, I mean, one of the things is that the relevant period is not the 25 years to which Sandra Day O'Connor referred. It was the 40 or 39 years since the passage of the Civil Rights Act. And the blunt truth, if you actually look at the numerical differences between races, they haven't diminished much over that period of time. And there hasn't been any change in the last 5 or 6 years. Now, one could make of this what you will, but I don't think that you're going to find that 18 or 19 years from now that all this will disappear. And I think she was wrong in another way. She said that what made it okay was that you had individualized determinations. That's okay when you're trying to run a small class in a law school of 180 students or so. But if you're trying to run the University of Michigan undergraduate program where you have 25,000 applicants, all of this stuff on individuals in interviews is inappropriate. And I thought that the Gratz case, which said that, no, you cannot use a numerical setback and to try to equalize the difference, was a mistake. I think you have to allow large and complicated institutions some degree of discretion on how they run their own affairs. I mean, my own position is much more radical than anybody's here. I called for many years for a repeal of the entire Civil Rights Act. And one of the reasons is that it turns out that affirmative action programs work lots better if they're not constantly under government scrutiny. And the world is going to be a lot better place if you could run an affirmative action program without constantly having to prove that there's been heavy doses of discrimination in the past. So right now you get this spectacle where civil rights groups are anxious to prove that their own governments have been horrendous so that they could continue to engage in affirmative action program. And that kind of destructive cultural activity seems to me something that we don't want any more of. Mm.
In its first landmark case on affirmative action, University of California versus Bakke in 1978, Supreme Court delivered a mixed opinion on the issue of using racial quotas. Here's a bit of that. The majority said that using strict quotas was wrong, but the swing vote, Justice Powell, also said that race might be legally considered as one of the factors. Here he is speaking from the bench as the justices read their decision. Thurgood Marshall gives a ringing endorsement of affirmative action.
It is because of a legacy of unequal treatment that we now must permit the institution of the society to give consideration to race to making decisions about who will hold the positions of influence, prestige, and influence in America. Far too long, the doors to those positions have been shut to Negroes. If we are ever to become a fully integrated society, one in which the color of a person's skin will not determine the opportunities available to him, we must be willing to take steps to open those doors.
Jess Braven, jump in here. Give us a historical perspective from Justice Marshall to now. Where might we be going legally?
Well, Justice Marshall was speaking at really sort of the tail end of a period where the court tended to endorse very aggressive measures to promote racial integration. In the 1970s, the court adopted the disparate impact standard. That is, you look at the statistical outcome of a test, for instance, to infer whether there was some kind of racial bias involved, and that's, I think, because at that period the civil rights laws were still relatively new, and whatever progress the people thought American society had made perhaps seemed precarious. In the 1980s, however, particularly after Justice O'Connor and other appointees of President Reagan joined the court, the question of have we gone too far, reverse discrimination, and so forth, began to arise in a number of cases where the court put limits on what kind of steps the government could take to promote this sort of diversity in schools and in the workplace and in the awarding of contracts and so forth. I think it's actually important to highlight the role of Justice O'Connor here, because she wrote some of those opinions in the 1980s that put limits on affirmative action and similar programs, and yet you heard her in that 2003 Michigan case leaving the door open for some consideration of race. In other words, Justice O'Connor seemed to indicate the middle ground on this, and she famously said that context matters when you deal with cases of this nature. And she saw a difference between the individual consideration in the law school admission system and the kind of mechanical, numerical formula that the undergraduate admission system in the same university, University of Michigan, made. And so a lot of people thought she did sort of speak for the contradictory impulses in American society as a whole. But she is now off the court, and I think that may account for some of the decisions the court has made in recent years when it comes to race-conscious government efforts. I think it's also worth pointing out that for the majority and the dissenters on the Supreme Court yesterday, what civil rights laws are about and what they mean and what they're supposed to do are very different things. For Justice Kennedy and the majority, they're looking at these laws, and their baseline date is 2003, which is when New Haven administered this firefighter exam. Okay. And they look at this exam pretty much from that standpoint and look at the steps that New Haven and its testing contractor took to try to make this a fair test. For the dissenters, and remember, there are four of them, it's a significant part of the court, that's really not the operative date. I mean, Justice Ginsburg begins her dissent by talking about what she calls the long history of racial bias in police and fire departments in particular. And the date that she starts talking about is 1971, which is when the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights issued a report on fire and public safety departments and how their workforces were not at all representative. And she even talks about New Haven. So for her and for the dissenters, there is a long history of racial bias in the country, and to ignore that history and just start in 2003 as if the past hadn't occurred is a mistake of perception.
Here's another call from Lexington, South Carolina. Paul is on the line. Paul, welcome to On Point.
Yes, hi, this is Paul. I just had a small comment. And I think there was no need for the case to go up to the Supreme Court. But that gave us a lesson about affirmative action. If our first American president won the mother of all tests, I think it's time to retire all the affirmative action laws once and forever. There is no time to cry for the past, but we have to get all together and look forward in the future. And that's all my comment.
Paul, thank you. Paul brings up an interesting point about a newly elected African-American president, Richard Ford. How do you see Barack Obama changing, or changing perceptions at least, of affirmative action civil rights law?
Well, I think that a lot of people might agree with that caller that Obama's election signals that we've overcome racism. I don't think that's right. There's lots of evidence that there's still discrimination that goes on today. And, you know, more importantly, and I think this goes back to Justice Ginsburg's dissent in the Ricci case, the effect of discrimination in the past hasn't gone away. So let's suppose it were true that we actually eliminated race discrimination today. The effect of race discrimination in the past has intergenerational consequences, and some of those consequences are that racial minorities have less wealth, they live in neighborhoods that are poor with failing schools, they are less likely to be legacy candidates for any number of jobs, from everything from the fire department, and that was one of the claims of the Ricci case, that white firefighters tended to have earlier generations in the fire department. Black firefighters had been shut out in earlier generations, and so they were more likely to be first generation firefighters, and therefore not and that put them potentially at a disadvantage on the standardized test. But you can say that about profession after profession and field after field. So the question is, how do we overcome this? Now, one idea would be, well, we just wait. And over time, these kind of effects will wash out. But that's going to take a long time, and it's going to lead to a lot of social discontent and, quite frankly, injustice in the meantime. Another approach, and the one that the Civil Rights Act has adopted, is that we try to do something about it to speed that process along and to speed us to a point where we really could say that everyone has equal opportunity. Mm.
Professor Epstein, let me jump in, Professor Ford, because I want to get Professor Epstein into the caller's point, to Paul's point about President Obama. And I actually pulled some clips from an interview that President Obama gave a reporter who asked him if he thought African Americans still need affirmative action. He said no. He said the average black American child would meet racism in his lifetime, but not the pervasive hatred faced by earlier generations, and not a kind that could be overcome by energy and initiative. So what do you make of the Obama effect, Professor Epstein?
Well, first of all, I don't think what Barack Obama's his own personal experience translates very easily into the way in which all other Americans leave their life. I think it's a very welcome development, and I think he's surely correct to say that the kind of institutional raw hatreds that I remember seeing when I was a child growing up in the 1950s, these really are, thank God, a thing of the past, and we deal with a very different situation. I also disagree with Richard on the way in which the original Civil Rights Act was done. Its strategy was very explicit. When you go back and you read both the testimony that was given in the Senate on the bill and some of the early commentaries, folks said the only thing an employer has to do is to play it straight. He's not responsible for prior conditions that existed in the larger society. Well, we want the workplace to be rid of these various kinds of considerations, but we certainly don't want employers to have to undertake constant efforts to correct any imbalances in education and otherwise. That vision has surely changed over the time, and this could be an open debate as to whether it's a good or a bad thing. But I also disagree with Richard Ford for another reason. I'm quite willing to allow institutions to have affirmative action, even if they don't think that there's a history of massive racist injustice in the United States. There are forward-looking justifications for the practice based upon the ability, for example, to have legitimacy in the communities in which you work. And if all of these things are true, what we really have to do, I think, is to rethink our policies from the ground up.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about fairness in this country and whether laws like affirmative action are the best way to achieve it. My guests this hour are Jess Braven, Supreme Court correspondent for The Wall Street Journal, Richard T. Ford, professor of law at Stanford, joining us from San Francisco, and Professor Richard Epstein, joining us from Chicago, where he also teaches law at the University of Chicago. Let's go right to the phones. Robert is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Robert, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Jane, how you doing?
Hello, fine. Go ahead.
Right. Well, I wanted to first, this is a subject that really requires a lot of detailed discussion in terms of the opportunity to do so, and I hope I have an opportunity to do some of that. Your first question that you came back from the introduction was, do you entrust your employer to do the right thing? Well, that question for African Americans or a minority is different from an answer for a majority race, such as the white race. No, I don't think most African Americans trust their employer to do the right thing, because and your second question was, is affirmative action still needed for a majority race? Affirmative action was really never needed, because they always had, or the majority race always had, the benefits of affirmative action. And when you're looking at affirmative action, it's affecting a separate group from the majority race. And you have to look at it from the perspective, if you're asking that question to one race, you're going to get a different answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because affirmative action really pulls from one group and gives to another group. I'm reading a book now, Slavery by Another Name, and if you look at the history of what is prescribed in that book by Mr. Blackmun, it talks about how African American males were, and tens and thousands of African American males had been taken in the South, in the Southern states, and used as laborers for slavery. Now, that's their generation and their families all were affected by that. It removed them from the economics of the country. It removed them from family and all of those things that have been imposed on African American. And now we're talking only 50 to 100 years later and saying, is affirmative action still necessary? For those that are benefiting from affirmative action, or for those that are not benefiting from affirmative action, no, it's not still necessary. When Justice Powell was in the court, that it was the most time that affirmative action moved in the right direction.
Robert, thanks so much for your call. Professor Epstein, would you respond to the caller?
Nobody here wants to fight the argument about the injustices of the past. The question is, which way do you do things going forward? I thought the most instructive remark of Justice O'Connor when she issued her decision in the Grutter case was that there had been actions, briefs written by the various industrialists and military people who said, we think affirmative action is a useful personnel tool, and she deferred to them. The way in which I would approach this problem is to say, if you don't trust this particular employer, there are lots of other employers out there. All of these affirmative action programs are voluntarily undertaken. None are required by law. The fact that you have white employers willing to do this suggests that some degree of trust is going to be warranted. And I think the key feature is to recognize that a national conversation is not necessarily the way to go. You want to have separate policies for separate firms based upon what the trade-off is between the meritocracy of tests and the other kinds of considerations. You're running Caltech and you're trying to get in a bunch of engineers and a physical scientist, you can't do much affirmative action and still have people do the program. If you're running a law school, you have a little bit more wiggle room. And I think once we recognize that kind of diversity, we should allow a little bit more to go on and be less straitjacket-like as the majority, but not as suspicious of the test as the minority, and not constantly harping back to 1971, when in fact there had been at least a complete changeover once, maybe twice, in all the personnel in all these departments.
Here's the other side of the coin from Dan. He's calling from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Dan, welcome to On Point.
Yes, well, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
This has been a most interesting discussion. I think the key is this. It seems to me intuitive that every employer, private or public, wants to hire the most competent individuals. Now, competence is defined in several fashions, and a pair of authors, Murray and Herrnstein, wrote years ago that if you have one applicant, hire them. If you got two, flip a coin. If you got three or more, test them. I think the tests are fair these days, but I really think that it should be obvious to most people, public or private, in the fire department, they want to hire the people that can most effectively search out, put out, otherwise know how to manage a fire. I don't know that there's any other criteria for any employer anywhere. In the private sector, they're trying to make a profit. So they'd like to hire men and women that are likely to help the business secure the greatest profit. I think all those things are relatively race insensitive. Mm. Now, you know, if it's an educational problem, yes, let's fix the educational systems. There's no doubt that there are some neighborhoods throughout this country where the schools are in relatively poor shape. Let's fix that. But let's not continue to whine about how, well, I'm just so terribly disadvantaged because I was born or raised in the wrong neighborhood. Let's help everybody to achieve, but then let's let the employers manage their own businesses and hire the guys, the gals that will help them achieve the greatest reasonable profit, ethics, morality, all of that included.
All right, Dan, thank you. Thanks for calling. Professor Ford?
Jane?
Yes.
Jester, I just wanted
Jess, go ahead.
Yeah, just wanted to add something based on Dan's call. I think that the facts in the Ricci case show that goal that he suggests is not really that simple, because there may be more than one way to evaluate how good someone might be a firefighter. And how far the city has to go in order to ensure that an equally good method is used that does not have such a disproportionate effect was really the issue in this case. The city took the position that if there are other tests that are just as good in evaluating firefighters that won't come up with a result that's this disproportionate, then we have a legal obligation to use them. And that's why they said they wanted to junk the test results that Mr. Ricci and the other 19 firefighters who sued did well on. Ricci and the people who already took the test said maybe there are other ways that are just as good as in evaluating firefighters, but this is the test that we already studied for, and we already took it, and we invested a lot in this, and you're depriving us of our expectation that we should get something for doing well in the test.
Was that you, Professor
Epstein?
And this
Epstein is really
yes,
the issue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Look, I mean, certainly I think what Jess is right. Going forward, pick whatever test you think to be best or suited. What was so troublesome about the complaint of the minority firefighters in this game is they didn't have a clue as to what alternative tests they wanted to put forward. All they said, this one is not good enough. You go figure out an alternative test. This entire area would be transformed if the attackers of a test were required to give a test that or demonstrate or show or make available a test which is better than the one they want to ditch. The truth about the matter is virtually all of these tests correlate with each other to about a 0.9 level anyhow, and so much of this stuff is just a mask for a very serious problem, which is when the disparities persist on the test, what do you do about it? And the answer is you trade off. Community relations matter. They're part of the merit that Dan has to consider. New Haven should be able to take that into account. The general rule on business judgments is you got to have a little bit of good faith. I don't think that when they ditched the test in this case, the New Haven city was acting in good faith. I think they knew it was a perfectly good test, and unfortunately they were denied the opportunity to combine the test with other results in a way which might have changed the mix of who was promoted and who not.
Here's another call from Roxbury, Massachusetts. Carrick is on the line waiting. Carrick, go ahead. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks. Uh-huh. I'd like to talk about a more general affirmative action problem, a misconception, I believe. Usually the storyline is, as in with the firefighters, where someone is accusing affirmative action as a pathway for underqualified people to get a job. But I think it's more often applied against racism to allow perfectly, profoundly qualified people to get the job or to get into school. And I'll give you a perfect example. I guarantee you that Sonia Sotomayor and Barack Obama were both beneficiaries of affirmative action during their education years, and I also guarantee you they were the smartest guys in every classroom they were in. But they
needed affirmative
action to get into the classroom.
Carrick, thank you. Was that you, Professor Ford?
Yeah, no, it was me.
Look,
Sonia Simon, she graduated summa cum laude. She's probably very, very able. Barack was a kind of a pretty good but not a spectacular student. He was a much better politician, as I think became evident. But my view about it is private institutions can figure out how to do this, and if you just leave them alone, they'll do a better job on this question than if you constantly have 9 justices of the Supreme Court trying to figure out which test they can use and which they cannot, which is, again, going back to what I said, the safest environment for affirmative action is to ditch the entitled Title VII proposal. The carrots work, the sticks do not.
Alan is in Cambridge, Massachusetts now. Alan, welcome to the program.
Yes, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
Point that I wanted to make is that I think the Supreme Court made the right decision. I am for minority rights and affirmative action as a general principle, but I think force-feeding this by rejecting tests and making people stay back and wait for promotions. I'll give you an example, the Bar Association exam. Let's say, for example, that all the law schools are forced to take X amount of minorities based on the amount in the particular city they're taking it. Say New York, 20% African-American, 30% Latin, et cetera. And if 20% don't pass the test of the bar, then all the results are thrown out, and all those lawyers that passed the bar are told, well, you have to stay as a paralegal for the next 5 years while you wait, and we'll let this thing litigate out, and we get it sorted out until there's absolute parity with the population pool. And in general, you all have to wait, and if it's going to be for one class of people like firemen, then it should be for all classes of people taking exams and tests, and it should be universal or none at all. I think affirmative action has run its course, and we have to move towards improving the educational system rather than trying to force feed this down the working class's throats.
Alan, thank you. That's one perspective. Here's Joe in Avon, Connecticut for another. Joe, welcome to the program.
Hi there. One thing that I've been listening throughout this whole situation, or actually not hearing throughout this whole situation, is why are they failing? No one's seems to be asking that question. Why do 90% of minorities fail these tests instead of simply going through the process of, you know, bantering back and forth?
Professor Ford, Joe, thank you so much. Do we need to be focusing on the wrong thing here? Should we be talking about education and other issues?
Well, I do think we should be talking about education and other issues as well. I've written quite a bit about that. But I wanted to say a few things about this, too. It's worth noting that one, there were other methods to evaluate firefighters, and they were addressed in the early litigation of the Ricci case. There's an assessment center type method that's very different than the standardized test that New Haven used. So there actually were other methods proposed, and those methods didn't have as large a disparate impact. So that was one of the things going on in the Ricci case. Was this the best way? And, in fact, most fire departments used the assessment center method and not the standardized test that New Haven used. So they were a little bit behind the state of the art there. Another thing was that the city was very much hemmed in, not only by the requirement that they use a test, which was part of the civil service rules, but also by a requirement that they weight the test in a particular way and that they rank and they only take the top people on the test. So if you compare that to, you know, the LSAT or something like that, it would be terrible if we were not only required to use the LSAT, but also to only take the top scorers and not consider anything else. In that sense, I agree entirely with Richard that a big problem is the way employers have been hemmed in so much, so that the test has to be everything. It's kind of all or nothing with the test. And, you know, finally, I just come back to saying why are the minorities not doing as well on the test? Now, in fact, a lot of them passed, but they didn't score in the very top range on Ricci. But, these intergenerational effects are real. They're not, and they have an effect on how minorities do. And so that's a reason that people are scoring less well on these tests.
Bill is now in Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, welcome to the program, and thank you for waiting, sir.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the Bakke decision. I totally agree with this particular decision. Mm-hmm. I am in favor of affirmative action, but I am not in favor of affirmative action no matter what. No one has mentioned yet what it was about this test that was so discriminatory. I haven't heard any of the questions. I haven't heard anything that said, yes, this favored one race as opposed to the other race. And if the affirmative action proponents do not stop bringing up cases like this, ridiculous cases like this, they are going to totally discredit any efforts at affirmative action. You're going to have a backlash on here that I am very much afraid of.
Bill, thank you. Jeff Braven, will you speak to that?
Well, we don't know exactly what's on the test because the last I checked, it was sealed. We do know the steps that the city took to try to make sure that it was not a discriminatory test. They're laid out in the Supreme Court opinion yesterday and in prior court filings. The test contractor interviewed a number of minority firefighters when it was developing its questions. 40% of the test was based on an oral exam conducted by a 3-firefighter panel. These were firefighters chosen from outside of New Haven, and each of these 3-member panels had 1 African-American and 1 Latino on it and 1 white firefighter. So they went out of their way to try to avoid things that might have a negative impact on minority applicants, according to the Supreme Court. But whatever it is they did, the black firefighters in New Haven contended just simply wasn't good enough, and that there was some suggestion that other methods like this assessment center, which wasn't exactly defined what it might be, mm-hmm. might be just as good as in evaluating how well someone can put out fires and yet not have the same kind of result. It's not just by the way.
Let me just finish because I only have about a minute left, and I wanted to get you on last word here about the public opinion toward affirmative action. There's this new CBS News New York Times poll out today which finds 50% of Americans in favor of programs that make special efforts to help minorities get ahead, affirmative action, 41% opposed. For over a decade, more Americans have favored affirmative action than has opposed it. Public opinion shifting on this issue, Jess, do you think?
Well, I don't really follow the polls, as some politicians and Supreme Court justices say they do, but I think that perhaps more significant is what do you really mean when you say affirmative action? The term tends to have somewhat different meanings. Justice Kennedy, who was the deciding vote here, and as he was 2 years ago in a school involving some voluntary efforts at integration in public schools, suggested that the distinction that he wants to draw in efforts to promote minority participation and minority opportunity is to have the government design programs in a general way, you know, put schools in neighborhoods where they're likely to draw an integrated student mm-hmm, body, mm-hmm. design tests at the outset that will be fair to minorities rather than change the results after the test is given or start selecting students as by race mm-hmm. as individuals. That was sort of the shift that he was pushing. That seems to be where the court is going, whether or not the public opinion is there as well.
Well, Jess Braven, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it. Richard Epstein, Richard Ford, thank you very much to both of you as well.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.